You're on the starship Voyager. I'm Captain Catherine Janeway of the United Federation of Planets.
I'm Dareth of the Vidian Sodality.
You attacked one of our crew members, and you've lured us into this asteroid. Why?
We are gathering replacement organs and suitable biomatter. It is the only way we have to fight the Phage.
Transfer complete.
And welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton dumping his space trash into a nebula.
Wow, is this a Star Trek Into Darkness reference?
You wish it was.
Yeah. Well, this week we are here to talk about Aliens of the Delta Quadrant.
Yeah, I think what we want to bring up is, like, obviously, like, the big notable ones. The ones that got a lot of attention throughout the run of Star Trek Voyager, but also kind of, like, the cool ones that maybe fans don't always talk about that I think are actually worth bringing up once again, Cam.
Yes. And, you know, the Alpha Quadrant aliens have such a rich history. You know, people talk so much about Klingons and Romulans and Vulcans, or even like some of the species we saw develop later in Enterprise, like Andorians. And I want to really look at, you know, a lot of the aliens of the Delta Quadrant. You know, Voyager had to create a whole new, you know, all these new races of aliens. And how many of them really stuck? And of the ones that didn't, like, why? Like, why did they not quite work?
And I also think it's worth noting, like, just a conceit of the entire series, though, is like, this is a ship that was on the move. It was not going to be visiting the neutral zone, you know, every fourth week.
Yeah.
So they could only spend a select period of time with a lot of these aliens until they would just eventually have to move on. But I think there's a couple instances where, like, well, you know, they could have had opportunities to encounter these fellas every once in a while. And I think that would be fun to dive into.
And maybe we can take a vote maybe at the end of each alien, just decide, like, should we, you know, see more of these in the future? Like, would that be an exciting prospect?
Yeah.
I think that would be fun.
So, Cam, why don't we just jump into it?
Yeah. And we should say up front, we're not going to talk about the Borg.
Yes. No, that's very important here.
You know, the Borg are all over the Delta Quadrant, but we've talked so much about the Borg. And if you want to hear all the Borg talk you could ever hope for regarding Voyager, jump on over to our Evolution of Borg episode. I'll have a link in the show notes of the podcast at subspacepod.com. You can also find it on your iTunes.
I think we did that one, like, that's around 125 or something like there.
Somewhere,
so if you
want
to go search through iTunes or Stitcher, what have you.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Cam, I'll throw it over to you. Because we're going to start off with the primary ones and then have some fun with the, I guess, I don't want to call them expendable, but the ones that don't get as much attention. But let's start with the primary ones here. What's top of the list?
Okay, well, let's start with the Talaxians. Because, you know, when it comes to aliens on the ships, you know, the Vulcans are beloved, or the Klingons on TNG. And so there was a, you know, a pretty big assignment on Voyager to bring in a new alien and give them a lot of personality. Quark had done wonders in terms of merchandising for Deep Space Nine. And really, Neelix, that was the role he was there to fulfill, was to be the new Quark, essentially.
Kind of their marketing arm, to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Like, the most recognizable out of all the crew.
Yeah, and
they didn't give him a cat suit. You know, that's bizarre to me.
I mean, Ethan Phillips just kept requesting one, but they wouldn't give him one.
No, I keep sending letters into Ethan Phillips requesting that he put one on.
But, you know, they introduced the Talaxians in the first episode, and they feel so vaguely sketched out. Like, I feel like with the Ferengi, you get so much interesting detail and layers. And a lot of the aliens we're going to talk about in this podcast episode are phased out after a season or two of Voyager. Whereas the Talaxian, you know, at least through Neelix, is there the entire series. Do you feel like they had an interesting hook for this alien species?
Okay, maybe not so much an interesting hook. I think it was very much introduced as kind of a character that was supposed to hook you in.
Right, based on The Lion King.
How so?
Michael Westmore said that was what was in his mind when he was designing the look of Neelix. Was he'd seen The Lion King and he'd been like, man, these characters are so colorful and you just want to hug them.
Okay.
And that was what was going through his mind.
It makes sense. I guess with kind of like the tones of his skin.
Neelix just wants to be king.
He's got the lion's mane.
Yeah.
But I think what we found over the course of the series, though, is like they're very much kind of a bit of a immigrant sort of species.
Yes.
Where like there's this diaspora that's going on, and we encounter them in, I think, a cool episode like Fair Trade at the end of season 3, where Neelix is like, this is as far as I've ever explored in the Delta Quadrant. I need a map to go further. And he hooks up with like an old friend. I think that was a fantastic Talaxian episode. And then also at the end of Neelix's journey, he finds like another colony living in like these meteorites.
Yeah, in the episode Homestead. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we get the sense that they are travelers. They do love to explore. And it makes sense that Neelix would hook up with a ship like Voyager. I also think that Jitrell was a very strong episode for kind of explaining why maybe the Talaxians have this diaspora that's going on right now because of this war that really just ravaged their home planet as
With the Hakonians, where they released this weapon that has just, like, decimated their planet. And, you know, now these people kind of don't have a home. The Hakonians have taken over. And so they are kind of these species that have just kind of filtered out throughout, you know, the Delta Quadrant.
For you, though, I mean, okay, do you look at the Talaxians and say that there is, you know, like kind of a rich history? Do you think that there's maybe a little bit of unfulfilled promise behind them? Where do you ultimately come down on the Talaxians, Cam?
To me, they just never found, I think, the hook that makes them something you really like latch onto. You know, with the Ferengi and Quark, you know, you have the whole prophet philosophy. With the Vulcans, you have the logic aspect. And these are main aliens on the show you're spending a lot of time with. Neelix is a main character on the show. I think they need to figure out what that is. Like, what is it about Talaxians that is something that you can filter your story through? Because that's the thing. These characters should offer a very unique point of view. And I mean, Neelix is kind of this childlike sense of wonder or whatever a lot of the time, but it doesn't feel like it's a specific point of view that is very tied to an alien species. Like, that's something that's looking at humanity in an interesting way.
Yeah. Right. They're genial.
Sure.
I'll give them that. Yeah. So, but would you have been interested in exploring the Talaxians more, or do you think it's just kind of fine what we got? I'm okay with what we got. I didn't have this compulsion to find out the entire Talax history. Or in Neelix's case, he's actually from Rhynax.
Right, yeah. Now, do you think you would have felt differently if they'd found a way to make the Talaxians just pop more as an alien species?
How would they have done that, though?
I don't know. Do you think, like, what is a quirk to these characters that they could have brought out? Like, I know that the one aspect of the Talaxians is, like, that they really love to engage in, like, storytelling. And I wonder if there would have been something interesting to have an alien species that is more, like, literary or just somehow more dramatic.
I think that would have grated on audiences. You like, listening to somebody deliver exposition as their primary characteristic.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I just wonder if there would be something to, you know, there's so much of a foundation of literature in Star Trek. You know, it's inspired all of the series. And I wonder if there would have been something to the idea of a character who's a storyteller. And how, like...
It worked out really well for Chief O'Brien on Deep Space Nine.
I knew you were going to throw that in my face.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm just trying to come up with an angle on this species that would make them stand out as opposed to just... Because I feel like a lot of what Neelix is the visual. Like, that is the Talaxian, is the visual.
Yeah.
And sort of the tragic backstory. But you could take that backstory and apply it to a lot of alien races, right?
I think ultimately there just maybe wasn't enough potential behind them. I don't think that they could have been realized in any more way than they already were.
Right.
So what's next on the list, Cameron?
Well, let's move on to the ones, you know, in the show we tied kind of to the Talaxians, which is the Ocampa, through the character of Kes and Neelix.
Okay. This is a fundamentally flawed species to explore in that their lifespan is 9 years, right?
They were based on insects.
Okay.
The idea was that they were an alien race who lived like insects.
And they were a pre-warp civilization that lived in a shopping mall underground, this desert planet.
A shopping mall?
Yeah. I think fundamentally they're a flawed, uninteresting sort of species. And I would say that Kes got a lot of cool standout episodes. Like, I'd say she probably had a half dozen, like, solid episodes throughout her 3 seasons. And let's be honest, Fury?
Right.
Say what you will, it's memorable.
It is memorable. Yeah. I will agree with that, yes.
But I don't think that there's really much history to harvest or cultivate from the Ocampan species. Where do you fall on them?
The incompetents are such weird ones to me, in that I feel like they offer more promise than we see with the Talaxians. You know, you have
really
well. Yes, with Kes, you have these sort of the development of like the telekinetic stuff, yeah. the telepathic stuff. I think the idea of this character that lives a short life. We can talk about how much sense that makes in terms of their accomplishments and everything like that. But I think in terms of the idea of them having short lifespan, that's different. We haven't seen that, and the idea that these characters have to, you know, encapsulate the richness of life in this amount of years. There's something about that that's different. And I think that's kind of interesting. And, you know, I feel like there's more promise to have a perspective that this alien species would have on Voyager's adventures than the Talaxian does.
Okay.
Now, you know, is it portrayed that way on the show? No, I don't think they ever figure out what to do with Kes, which is why she's gone after season 3. But I do like that it seems like they're interested in introducing elements to this character.
Really? Because I think that they took the hook of the character and completely forgot about it very quickly into the run of the series. And then they were trying to retcon it. And yeah. that's why you're introduced to her going through that chronoton sort of right. like medical treatment to expand her lifespan.
Yeah.
So I don't think they ever really were interested in like the ultimate hook of the character. I don't think they were ever invested in it. And I think that's... And I think it's, like I said, like from the writer's perspective, it was kind of flawed. And that's why they could never really figure out what to do with her.
Do you think that this could have been salvaged? Like, do you think no, that there was ever a good idea here?
No, really? I ultimately do not. And I think it was maybe a good idea for like a one-off alien species featured in the pilot episode, Caretaker. I understand why the Caretaker would want to take care
sure.
of
these little elf kind of pixie characters.
Elfish yeah. sort of characters.
It was funny. I could not find any sort of quote in. I was doing research on sort of the development of all these various aliens, and I couldn't find anyone say, like, we want to do, like, elves or pixies in space. No one said that. And I was like, really? That seems so obvious to me. Yeah. Right. But, you know, to me, like, I think there would have been something kind of poignant about a character, had they stuck to this sort of thing, had Kes lasted the whole series, whose lifespan was the journey.
But then I think that's more of a character point yeah. versus like a species
sure,
point.
Sure, sure. So. But I think that would have been poignant in terms of using that character. It's like speaking through Kes.
Okay.
Her whole life was the journey, and that's what meant the most about her life. Whereas to these other characters, the journey is just like, we just want to get home and continue our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there would have been something there. They just never went for it.
Right. Cam, what's next here?
Okay, now this is one that I think...
Can I just say this?
Yeah.
I told you before we started recording, let's go with the most exciting
yes,
at the top.
And we did.
And you started with the Talaxians and the Incompetents.
We went with the fireworks and fanfare.
Give me yeah. an exciting one here.
Okay, we got to talk about the Kazon.
Okay.
Because the Kazon, okay, this is the big exciting ones.
The three most uninteresting characters from yes, the Delta Quadrant.
But it's that, all gold after this.
This is how you want to kick off the episode, Cam.
Yes, it is.
Okay, listeners, I promise you it'll get better. But yes. Cam, okay, thank you. Let's
the journey of Voyager. The Kazon are just fascinating to me because it seems like there was a lot of battling behind the scenes to make the Kazon work. Like, it seems like there was a real struggle between Piller and Taylor about the Kazon, that this was going to be their big new species. This was going to fuel at least a couple seasons of Voyager, and it just never worked. And I think it's really fascinating to hear how much effort went into the development of them, because they were based on like LA street gangs. Like the Crips and the Bloods was all in the news at that point.
I know.
And I think it actually adds a really problematic element to the Kazon in,
but, okay,
especially now.
Take a look at the writer's room where
yeah.
it was primarily white males,
exactly.
save for Jerry Taylor.
Yeah.
And I think a couple years later, Lisa Klink joined the cast, but it was primarily a white male dominated writer's room.
Yes.
Lisa Klink not joined the cast, but joined the yeah. writer's room. And so you have them kind of transposing this idea of like L.A. street gangs.
And they were a subjugated species who got freedom.
I know.
And
this,
originally,
they
wanted to cast only 18 to 25-year-olds and make them like teenagers. That would have been something, right? Mm-hmm. But to me, it's funny because there's a lot of problematic elements in terms of the creation of the Kazon. Stuff that now we would be like, oh, they shouldn't have done that. Do you think this ever comes across, though, on the show?
The problematic elements?
Yeah. Like, do you think someone who's watching the Kazon in 2018 is sitting there
like,
being like, this is
up.
Problematic? Because there's a lot of movies
right.
of that era,
yeah.
For example, that use
Dangerous
a lot of, like...
Minds?
I was thinking a lot of the action movies that use, like, Jamaican gangs. And uh-huh. it's very problematic now.
Yeah.
But I think the Kazon kind of get by scot-free. Like, they
yeah.
don't feel as... kind of like laden with problems as maybe even like the original series Klingons do.
I agree. Well, let's talk about, I think, what would be kind of the most important like arc of this Kazon journey that we had over, I think, was a way too long extended period.
Yeah.
Which was over the course of the first three seasons of the show. But, I guess the first two seasons,
yeah,
I should
say. Yeah, first
two. But I think the kind of the Jonas arc that culminated with the episode Investigations.
Right.
Where they were trying to do serialized storytelling on Voyager. And it was telling that they said, like, yeah, we tried serialization on Voyager. It didn't work based on this Kazon arc here. We're never going to do it again.
Right.
Even though Voyager did have elements of some serializations, or at least callbacks that they would bring back other species, but it wasn't a very serialized TV show. Although, Cam, did you read the interview with Snuka Martin Green where she kept talking about how serialized Voyager was?
Right, yeah.
I was like, are you sure you're watching the same series?
Yeah.
Like, no, Voyager was probably the least serialized, like, modern series, like, post-TNG out of all of them. Anyways, SMG, I love you. I'm just taking issue with one comment there. And so, ultimately, it does culminate. Okay, post-investigations.
Yes.
We do get the basics two-parter, which I actually think is, like, a pretty decent, like, two-parter.
Yeah, and don't think they ever make the character of Maj Kala someone who we really care that much about. But no. I think they found an interesting angle on at least paying off that story.
Yeah. Look, they're the obsessed. Seska. Look, they're a less advanced technologically species.
Yeah.
And they want to acquire.
Yeah.
You know, a more advanced technology. It makes sense. And after 2 years, they actually acquire Voyager.
Yeah.
And they're defeated by Tom Paris and Talaxians.
Yeah.
Which, there you go. And Lon Suter, the murderous, like, Betazoid.
What do you think of the aspect of them being, like, these 18 different sects, and they each have control over different resources? It's kind of like Catan. And like, to me, this feels a little too similar to, like, the Houses of the Klingons.
Sure. But they were a Klingon ripoff, right?
They were a Klingon. Well, that's what Brennan Braga straight up said, you know, because when originally, like, Pillar was the one who really wanted to fight to keep them. He was saying they could have been one of the top five species on Star Trek.
No, Pillar.
Yeah, nope. I know. Whereas Cherry Taylor was like, nope, moving on. And Brennan Braga backed her as well as Rick Berman. And yeah, Braga said, no, it's a ripoff Klingons.
So then why didn't they never work, Cam?
I don't know, because it's weird to me in the sense, in like, when I look at the development of these various alien races on Voyager, it seemed like the Kazon were the ones they really put maybe the most thought and effort into.
I would say so. For those first two seasons, yes.
Yeah, and it's just very strange. And I you know, it's funny because, like, there's the episode Alliances,
where
we really get this breakdown of how the Kazon work. And I feel like that should be an episode I should care about. Like, you know, you look at a TNG two-parter, for example, like Redemption, which is a lot about the Klingon politics and that sort of thing. And there's a lot of Klingon politics episodes in DS9 as well. And I think they find a way to really bring you into the politics of the Klingon society and make it interesting and vital. Whereas, like, when I sat through Alliances, that Voyager episode, and I'm hearing a lot about the Kazon politics, it is not working.
I don't think I'll ever make the argument that Alliances is a great episode of Voyager, but it's the first time that I actually thought, like, oh, there's layers to the Kazon.
Yeah. Oh, I would never argue that there aren't layers.
Yeah.
They never felt, like, vital or, like, something really, like, gripping.
So, you know, Cam, Kazon, never cared about them, never will care about them. They never worked for me. Give me a good species here. What's next on the list?
I guess we should say, first off, would you like to see, between these three, do you think you would like to see any of these again, like the Ocampa, the Talaxians, or the Kazon?
Between the three, I would go with the Talaxians, and that's primarily based on the episode Fair Trade, where Neelix is interacting with his old partner, and we get to see Dark Neelix a little bit.
Right.
That worked for me, and you kind of get the different shades within that. But the other kind of Talaxian episodes, I'm just not into. But then I look at the other ones that you know, like, put out there.
Yeah.
I guess I have to go with Talaxians. What about you?
I think I'd agree. I think the Kazon are just kind of DOA.
Yeah.
I just don't think they ever found a way to make them interesting. It's like, it's almost like they put far more effort into explaining their backstory than actually giving them personality. And I think that's kind of the problem. Whereas I feel like the Talaxians, there's enough there to kind of try and get something out of them. I love the episode J'Trell, and I think there's a lot of tragedy.
Really good.
I think that's probably the best Neelix episode there is. And I could see how you could mine that sort of material for a Talaxian species in the future. I don't know if they're ever going to do that. But
I don't think they will.
Talaxian captain on the next post-Voyager Star Trek series?
Star Trek Rhinax? Is that the next spinoff?
Get out of my head. That's my fan fiction script.
Okay.
Okay, well, let's move on to one I think is a lot cooler than the previous three, and that's the Vidians.
Thank you. Okay, for listeners there, Cam, sometimes I like to put like Star Trek figures on the table as we record the episodes. I made sure I put down a Vidian figure right next to the soundboard.
I thought that was mutated. Tom Paris.
Did you really?
No.
Oh, okay. It doesn't look too dissimilar.
No,
though.
It looks actually very, it might be from the same mold, actually. It wouldn't surprise me.
I think the Vidians are just one of the cool. I'll throw it out there. They might be the coolest Voyager alien that we ever got, in that they were so unique. And I think the other thing here is like you totally 100% understand their motive.
We talk about like the Talaxians and the Ocampa being not great in terms of setting them up as having a hook to them, whereas I think the Vidians have that in spades.
The thing I hate about some of these Star Trek aliens is like they're evil because they're evil.
Right.
Where it's like the reason they're harvesting organs is it's for their own survival. It's like all they want to do is survive. They had a rich history. This was established in other episodes. Was it Life Science? Is that the one with the doctor?
The doctor, yeah. And that is one. Yeah. I think, you know, it's funny. I don't know if at the time Life Science popped out to me as one of my favorite Voyager episodes, but it's one of the ones I think the most about, you know, since finishing the series. Like, I really love that episode a lot.
And
that's the one we should say where the doctor is trying to deal with this female doctor who's a Vidian and trying to heal her, and there's kind of a love story there.
And, like, and he kind of recreates, like, a holographic version of her, and we see what the Vidians looked like originally.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, this is fascinating. I'm also going to throw this one out there, and I alluded to it earlier, but Fury, and the reason why I highlight Fury is because we go back in time with this Kes story, and Kes, I mean, the angry Kes is going to give the Voyager crew up to the Vidians.
Right.
But to me, this is a Brian Fuller script, and I think he was maybe one of the few writers that really understood how kind of cool and funky the Vidians were.
Yeah.
And look, if you ever watched Hannibal or anything like that, you can kind of understand the lineage of Brian Fuller being interested in the Vidians. But I think it's cool that he realized like how like frightening they were. But the thing is they actually had strong motive, like with what they were pursuing. And that's what makes them actually interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, I like that, you know, we've talked a lot in the past about how a lot of the time Star Trek would present the quote-unquote ugly aliens, and they were the evil aliens that the crew was dealing with. What I like about the Vidians is that there's the idea that while they look, you know, repulsive to, say, the human eye or whatever, there's something about them that this happened for a reason. It's not just like they were genetically born this way, and therefore they are our enemies. You know, it's like, no, they were once good people who are desperate. And I think that ties beautifully into the theme of Voyager, of this crew stuck in the middle of nowhere. And there is, at least in theory, there should be an element of desperation to their journey. And it's like the Vidians are also very desperate. And that these two forces kind of come head to head. Now,
maybe we should have tracked the adventures of the Equinox and the Vidians if we wanted better, stronger parallels.
Yeah. But, you know, how do you feel about them resolving sort of the Vidian story in just kind of a line of dialogue and
think tank?
The episode of Jason Alexander.
I will say this, like, we were never going to get an opportunity again to explore the Vidians. So the fact that we know that they had a happy ending, I'm okay with that. You know, it
gives you something.
It took away the hook of them. So they're now no longer interesting. Although it would be kind of interesting to go back and kind of explore, like, how do they reintegrate to their way of life now that every day isn't just a fight for survival where you're harvesting organs, stealing Talaxian lungs, so to speak, you know, or ripping off the faces of Voyager crew members.
Do you think the show realized what they had with the Vidians?
No. I think Brian Fuller did, but he was a viewer for many a year, and that's what he... Okay, so I'm going to digress for just a second, because I recall we were at a convention, and somebody had asked, you know, kind of about the Brian Fuller influence in the writer's room, and I remember, I forget who it was, but they were talking about, like, when he was pitching ideas for the Deep Space Nine episode he did, Impok Nor.
Yeah.
And just throwing things out there, like, hey, do you guys still have the EV suit from Star Trek First Contact? Why don't we integrate that into Impok Nor somehow? Like, right. he was kind of doing, like, the fan service-y sort of stuff, but, like, doing it in a way that it's just like, hey, that's a cool visual. And if you see something, watch any Brian Fuller show, they're not boring from a visual perspective. And I think that's why maybe he was drawn to the Vidians as well, because they weren't boring at all in either their concept or execution.
It's interesting, though, that you mentioned Equinox a couple minutes ago, you know, and I think, you know, that's a really, really great Voyager story. And I think the Vidian stories are really, really great. And to me, it's interesting how both of these, there's that element of desperation and survival to them. And it's something that I think pinpoints what would have really helped Voyager a lot, is to just tap into these themes more. I don't think necessarily, because I know there's been talk in the years since that, like, look, that wasn't kind of what the show was supposed to be. You know, it was about upholding Starfleet values and all that sort of stuff. We don't want to see this crew kind of coming apart at the seams. That's fine. But I think if you bring in these themes of desperation, it acts as a really good kind of mirror reflection of what Voyager is, like what Voyager could be.
But I think some of the strongest episodes of Voyager, whether it's two-parters or just one-offs, is when they're showing Janeway kind of in that desperate mode where they're just trying to fight for survival. They're trying to form alliances.
In two-parters, usually.
Yeah. You know? And so I think that's like their strongest suit. And they really never went to that well too often. Was that to their detriment or to the benefit? The fact that they weren't constantly there? Like, I think Voyager could have been a difficult series to watch if every single episode it was just like a kind of a desperate fight for survival.
Yeah, well, we talked last week about, you know, would Year of Hell have worked as a whole season? And it might have been a bit punishing.
It might have. I think it could have ultimately worked if they had paced it sufficiently.
Yeah.
And I think one of the problems, I was thinking about this, though, you know, one of the problems I think with season one of Discovery, though, is like, the whole serialized storytelling aspect, it's like the serialized element was always kind of, well, more often than not, the A story. Mm-hmm. And I think really the serialized element should have been the B story. And you should have had A stories that were more of those kind of high concept sci-fi sort of things. So I think if they had done that with Year of Hell, I mean, that totally would have worked.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Okay, so ultimately, Cam, we like the Vidians?
We do. I was going to say, though, the one thing that I think the Vidians do really well that, say, the Borg don't. The Borg introduces the character of Hugh, and we see kind of from that point, they start to introduce characters like Icheb, and a lot of these characters begin to take away from the mystique of the Borg and kind of make them less threatening or less interesting. I think, actually, them introducing these Vidians who want to be healed, like the one dealing with the doctor in Life Science, I think that makes them actually much more like interesting and emotionally affecting. I don't think it has the effect on the Vidians that that happens with the Borg. Like, I don't feel like the Vidians just become uninteresting once we kind of humanize them more.
I agree. No, I think they become richer because of that.
Why do you think that is? Like, why does it hurt the Borg, but the Vidians it works?
Because we understand the ultimate internal conflict going on with them. Whereas the Borg, what is their conflict ultimately? Right. There is really no internal conflict
within
the
Borg. Well,
the
people there don't really have the ability to have much conflict.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I think you can totally picture, let's say, the Federation being overcome with this phage virus.
Sure.
You can understand.
Engineered by Section 31?
Yeah. Oh, dear. For all those listeners, Cam and I, we're not looking forward to the Section 31 plot line coming up in Season 2 of Star Trek Discovery.
That would be amazing if they introduced that and said, we're going to send that to the Delta Quadrant for testing.
Yeah. Anyway, but like, we can understand the Federation kind of, I guess, devolving into this scenario. And I think it's something that is something we can relate to. And I think that's kind of the key to the Vidians. Are you with me, though? Like, do you think the Vidians might be the richest, or at least kind of in concept, kind of the coolest sort of Delta Quadrant aliens? Or do you want to save that for a little bit later on?
I think I would agree with you
in
that regard. I mean, we can argue back and forth about the Borg, because the Borg, you got to also include all the stuff in TNG in the sense of, like, them as a species. I think the Borg are actually really interesting. Voyager doesn't necessarily always use them to their best effect, but there's a lot more to the canon of Borg than there is to the Vidians. But I do think the Vidians feel, maybe the reason they feel so effective is because there's such a limited number of episodes.
Wait, sorry, did she say the canon of Borg or Locutus of Borg?
Go waka
on.
Waka.
Go on. Okay. Okay. What's next on the list?
Let's move on to one I think is maddening in its usage, which is species 8472.
Okay. Okay.
Which, yeah. Okay. These things are introduced in the two-parter Scorpion. We did a review on that a couple months ago, I think.
No, no, no. Like mere weeks ago.
Was it? I can't keep track anymore.
I think like 2 months ago. You're right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And, you know, when these things are introduced, they are doing their best of both worlds two-parter. Like, they are like, here is the next new badasses of this series. This CG purple three-legged species that are so powerful, even the Borg can't take them.
Yeah.
And what did they do with them after that?
Well, they assigned them to Starfleet Academy, Cameron.
You know, we get that one episode, Prey, where we get one on a ship
reenacting
the movie Alien while being hunted by a...
Reenacting Alien or reenacting Macrocosm from season 3.
But yeah, you know, doing that sort of spiel. And, you know, that's kind of it. Like, these aliens are, you know, we see at the end of Scorpion, they get hit with a massive weapon and retreat, and they never really come back. Yeah. And we ultimately find them creating this simulated training program of Starfleet Academy with Boothby and things like that. Okay, we got to talk about that.
Okay.
Does this make any sense?
Like, no, to me, not at all. Because
this is like someone who wrote this was on a fever dream. They weren't cognizant of their own abilities. Like, they were just like, someone was like, not well, and they handed them a pen and paper and were like, just keep writing.
Do you think that episode would have been better had it not involved species 8472? If it was an alien, a Delta Quadrant alien that just wanted to learn more about how to hypothetically infiltrate Starfleet?
Maybe.
All the way on the other side of the galaxy.
That's the thing that does not make sense to me. Like, I don't understand why this species in the Delta Quadrant is making a simulation of Starfleet Academy.
Yeah, I know.
It's ridiculous.
Taking Chakotay out for drinks.
Yeah, and to me, like, species 8472, when presented in Scorpion, you know, we can go back and forth on whether the visual worked. I think the CG has not aged well. TV CG is a little iffy.
I'll say, at the time, they look like a pretty cool badass alien. I remember my reaction at the time. I was like, "Hey, this is pretty awesome."
Yeah, well,
I dug it,
and I like that they feel very "quote unquote" you know, alien. Like, they feel like something we've never seen on Star Trek.
I agree. Yeah,
and you know, the one of them takes out Harry Kim with the swipe, and he gets all infected. Like, there's a sense of real danger to these. I like their eyes have that weird, the cross pupils,
the tripod look.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty badass.
The living in fluidic space. Like, we haven't heard terms like this on Star Trek.
Yeah.
And to me, that's really bringing something to Voyager like, we've never seen.
They're genuinely unique and imaginative. They clearly put a lot of thought into these aliens. And so I think for Scorpion Parts 1 and 2, hell yeah, I'm there. Prey, hell yeah, I'm there.
I love Prey, yeah.
Do you think their swan song is really what does them in, though? Is it Flesh and Blood? Is that...
That's the Starfleet Academy episode. It's funny, like, I remember watching that episode very vividly and, you know, reading ahead, like, just the synopsis, I guess, on IMDb or something. It's a 8472 episode. I was like, oh, cool. You know, I really liked the previous two. And sitting there the whole time, not even be able to make the mental connection that the characters I'm seeing on screen are 8472.
I know.
Like, it does not compute. At all.
Is it like watching Alden Ehrenreich pretending to be Harrison Ford in Solo?
Yeah, maybe we'll talk about that a little later.
Okay.
But, it kind of is, where it's just, it doesn't make sense to me. Like, had you said, I don't know, the Vidians are doing this, or something. Like, something a little, to me, like, the thing is, like, when I think about 8472, to me, what makes them interesting is that they are an alien species that has nothing to connect to the humans with.
Exactly. They're completely alien.
Yes, whereas all the others, it's like, you know, the Vidians were really good artists, for example. You know what I mean? So it's like, okay, they can connect over something like art or, you know, obviously the Doctor has the romance with the female Vidian. So they can connect on that level. Whereas the 8472, they don't understand these humans.
And then when their motivation seems to be all too human.
Yes.
It's like, well, that takes away kind of the badass cool factor that they originally possessed.
Why did they do this? I mean, I would imagine these characters were kind of expensive, so you weren't going to see them that many times on screen. But
Why did they do this?
I think Prey is a great episode. You can't say like they had a slam bag intro in Scorpion and then really failed them the second time.
Do you think they just got a little bit ahead of themselves? They're like, well, you know, we did it with Scorpion. We did it with Prey. It sounds wild, guys, but let's put 8472 into Starfleet Academy. Fake Starfleet Academy, holographic sort of recreation, you know, this weird space station. But it just, it removed
everything.
It made them look like dopes.
I could understand if they're writing themselves into a corner, like say the Kazon. You know, by the time you were getting to the end of the Kazon arc in Basics, I don't think they had anything left. I think they were like, we are done, moving on.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, you end the episode Prey, which is a really great episode. I don't feel like they'd written themselves into a corner where it's like, we got to pay these things off and move on.
I think there's a lot more to explore with 8472 had it not left off with this
insane
episode.
This is one of the most insane Star Trek episodes, I think, in terms of what it is trying to accomplish.
Do you recall who wrote this one or who has a writing credit?
I can't remember.
I think it might be Brad Yacobian. I'm not 100% sure. But
he's listening like, no, it wasn't me.
It wasn't me. Oh, yeah. I'm going to look it up. Next time we're at a Star Trek convention and the writer's up there, I need to ask him or her what this is all about. So
and they were Kate Mulgrew's favorite alien on the show, too.
Huh?
She obviously didn't have that much power on the set to be like, you know, bring back the 8472.
All right. Well, what's next on the list here, sir?
Okay, well, let's move on to, you know, this. We talked about Prey. Let's move into the Hirogen. Now, the Hirogen are a species that I actually really enjoyed their episodes, even though they are, as the writers themselves admitted, a bald-faced Predator ripoff.
Sure.
You know.
I'll take it.
Sure. Yeah.
But look, they are distinct looking.
Yes.
And here's the other thing, though. They have a richness to their culture. It actually looks as if they put thought into, I guess, like different hierarchies within this culture. And they didn't seem like Klingon ripoffs the same way that Kazons did, even though they're very much kind of a predatory sort of warrior sort of culture as well.
Yeah.
What is it about the Hirogen that just worked for you, Cam, that didn't necessarily work with other kind of ripoff species that maybe we encountered?
I mean, I'm not as sold on the visual look. I actually, when I think
What about the armor, though? I'm sold
the
on the armor.
All right. I think the problem is when you're emulating Predator, the Predator creation, as done by Stan Winston, is so incredible that to evoke it, you have to really bring something to the table that feels, to me, like something very cool looking. And I never felt like the Hirogens worked on a visual level.
I would never look into it to that degree. Like I think they're evoking it more in spirit, more so than execution.
But it's so obvious that I'm like, you know, you got to just make these things, I think, look, to me, more unique.
Nah, I don't know. I'm sold on the look. No, that was never an issue for me. Like, because I actually thought the look of them was actually pretty cool.
I'm okay, but like, I look at something like, for example, the reptilian Zindi.
Yeah.
And I would have liked something maybe a little more in that direction. Something that felt a little more ambitious or just interesting visually.
But I'm looking at this within the Star Trek universe.
Yes.
What species do they look like? Like, to me, I don't think they're derivative of anything that we've encountered before, from the armor to the actual, like, when they take the helmets off and you see what they look like.
I mean,
and look, they even have, like, the war paint that they put on, which I think is a pretty cool thing. It's clear that they put a lot of thought into these. So, like, I'm not hung up on the whole kind of Predator sort of.
I mean, if you, you know, really, you know, phaser to my head, ask me, like, what species they remind me of visually, I don't think it's a one-to-one comparison, but I see a little bit of the Jem'Hadar there.
Sure, yeah. I buy that.
You know, the Jem'Hadar with kind of different, you know, more bulkier armor, essentially.
But I would say, like, honestly, like, other than the Vidians, I think the Hirogen might be, you can make another argument that these might be the next best original DQ aliens that were introduced on the series.
Yeah, and it's funny. It was, again, you know, we talked, you know, about the Kazon and how much effort went into the creation of these, whereas, like, these guys, they, you know, Predator was a big part, but it really happened because it was Brian Fuller and Brandon Braga were watching the NFL. And then Braga was like, what happened if the NFL players were aliens?
Okay.
And it was just like the idea of having these big, guys standing opposite your crew.
I know that they, for at least the first couple episodes, they made an effort to hire, like, hulking actors.
Yes. And Tony Todd is not a small man when he shows up in Prey.
But then you end up casting people like J.G. Hertzler.
What are you talking about, Tyler? He's a monster.
If you ever encounter him in real life, he's just a normal sized dude.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I actually think he might be my favorite visually.
Okay.
Just because of, I think, what J.G. Hertzler brings just through his facial features. There's something about that look in the martial arts trainer in Sun Katsi that there's something very memorable about that character's face versus, you know, the first Hirogens we see.
He seemed weathered.
Yes.
To a certain degree.
Well, he was pretty weathered.
Do you think Robert O'Reilly could have played like a pretty badass Hirogen?
No.
No? Okay.
I mean, what alien do you think would be? Because Robert O'Reilly, did he ever play any other aliens?
No, he was only ever Gowron.
Why?
Like, I find that shocking.
Do you think
shocking.
He was too recognizable?
I think that's what the issue was.
Which species do you think he would have been good at? Is there one that jumps out to you as like, would have been fun to see Robert O'Reilly tackle?
Yes, a Vorta.
Oh, that's a good one.
I think that would have been, but I think the problem would have been because like Gowron still exists within that DS9 universe.
Sure.
I think, you know, we know Jeffrey Combs. We just talked about him very recently on the podcast. Jeffrey Combs could coexist as like four different characters, you know, simultaneously on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah,
I don't think Robert O'Reilly could. He would have been a great Vorta. I don't know, maybe a Vidian, because like there's just so much like messed up looking facial features on caked on him.
I just wonder if the problem is his eyes. They're too memorable.
But I think the thing is like he pops the eyes as part of his acting thing. I think could, I guess, sink them in to a certain degree, you know. I don't know. What about
make
you?
Make him like a Breen.
Yeah. That'd be not a waste of Robert O'Reilly.
Yeah.
What about you? Like, what do you think he could play? What do you think would be a good Robert O'Reilly? Like,
the one that popped into my head immediately was the Talosians. Because the Talosians do that kind of wide-eyed look a lot of the time when they're trying to, you know, control people.
But would he not have been too recognizable as Robert O'Reilly?
I just wonder if I would still just love it so much. Because he's such a fun actor to watch.
I think maybe, I'm thinking about it now, maybe a Cardassian. I think he could have been a fun Cardassian, you know.
That could have worked for sure.
He would sink in the eyes.
Especially if you did like the Cardassians on TNG, the early ones, which had a little more like facial, kind of armor or what have you.
They wear those milk carton suits.
Yeah, yeah. Like you could have thrown something on him there where it makes him less recognizable.
Yeah. Okay. But, so we dig the Hirogen.
Yeah. Do you think there was more to do with the Hirogen? Because we see, you know, they have these really strong episodes in Prey, and then we get into them doing like holodeck stuff with the Killing Game as well as, Flesh and Blood?
I think they're... Oh, yeah, with the all the various holographic representations of possible Prey.
That's
actually not a bad episode.
I'm looking forward to revisiting that in the two-parters. Yeah.
That one is actually, it was funny. It was on cable TV just a few nights ago, and I was just flipping around the channels. I think there's another show that I wanted to watch, but that one was airing, and I just remember I think it was the representation of the Bajoran colonel who was kind of in charge of everything. And it's like, this is actually a fun episode. Like, I ended up watching for like 10 minutes more than I thought I would. And
it's
like,
not a feature length Voyager episode, because I believe it was aired as one episode, not as a two-parter. Yes. But it's not an extended episode you hear people reference much at all.
It's pretty good.
But I mean, honestly, my memory was that I liked it more than The Killing Game by a significant margin.
Yeah. I would say this about the Hirogen. I think they were actually on Voyager the perfect amount of time.
Right.
Like, where I never soured on them, like, maybe the way I did in 472.
Right.
They seemed cool. They worked. And then Voyager ended up getting out of their territory.
Yeah.
And so it made sense to me.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I think they have, you know, kind of going off the idea that they're based on Predator. Predator has not worked the more they've explored it. Like, there's something about these aliens. Like their culture is interesting, but it's not, like, really expansive and rich. You know, you set it up, you get some really great episodes out of it, but you can only do so much, and it's best to just kind of move them on. And I think they made the right choice. I think, you know, the Predator sequels have never managed to, you know, echo Predator in terms of quality. And
You're not a Paul W.S. Anderson fan, Cam?
No. Yeah. And, you know, my fingers are crossed for Shane Black's The Predator coming out, but
although
I'm hearing a lot of iffy things.
We actually have an inside source on that one.
The Predator.
Yeah,
we can't understand him. He just makes clicking noises. Yeah. But
we do have an inside source on that one because they filmed that movie here in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And despite the Shane Black, I guess, pedigree that's behind it, it doesn't sound as if this is going to turn out to be so awesome.
You don't open it in September if you've got high hopes.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't cheap.
That bums me out, though.
Yeah, it does.
All right,
does.
Cam, but, what's next here?
Well, let's, you know, close out the main Voyager aliens with a bang. And let's talk about the Malon.
You laugh. I find them fascinating.
They are definitely, to me, stand out as one of the weirdest alien creations in the history of Star Trek.
They're the ones that I was alluding to at the very beginning of this episode, and they're just so distinct, but then I think they're also applicable to kind of like today's society. And I know
they definitely are.
I'm getting into very much like a Vancouver-centric sort of viewpoint here.
People love that.
Yeah, but it's like recently, City of Vancouver voted to ban plastic straws as a bylaw across the entire city. And it's just kind of like the whole idea of like waste and like how wasteful we are. And just looking at the species that is just so gross and toxic and just they love to pollute and like and they look like they do as well.
Yeah.
How come we never got to see a male on woman though? Like that.
That's an excellent question.
That bums me out. Yeah.
I just think they maybe felt sorry for any actress made to look like a male on.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, this is a bad look for anyone. No, I don't know that a lot of actresses are signing up to be, I want that on my CV. I want that on my reel.
Oh, you know what? It's Hollywood.
It's true.
People would have done that. But what do you make? Okay. Because I think when we reference male on.
Yeah.
And Star Trek Voyager fans, their ears will perk up at this. Like, what is it about the male on that makes them so memorable and distinctive within, like, I guess, Star Trek canon?
I mean, to me, of the Voyager aliens, I feel the most of their time.
Yeah.
In the sense, you know, you think about a lot of the anti-pollution stuff coming out and environmentalism coming out in, like, entertainment at that time. You know, you had, like, shows like Captain Planet.
Yeah.
You had that episode of Saved by the Bell where they struck oil. And then they killed Zach's duck with the oil foil.
I forgot about that.
It was Becky. R.I.P. Becky.
Yeah.
You know, you had a lot of that stuff coming into entertainment. What was that show? That awful cartoon show. Was it the Toxies? What was it?
The Toxic Crusaders?
Well, there was Toxic Crusaders, which was based on the movie Toxic Avenger. It was like the kiddie version. But there was that, oh man, it was like the group of like creatures that polluted. And I can't remember what it was called, but like there was also these other characters that were like fairies that kind of battled them. It was Toxies, I think, or something like that. But there was a lot of this sort of stuff in at least children's entertainment. And so it makes sense to me that a lot of this environmental messages, and let's be honest, they're very heavy-handed environmental messages, but they're crossing into Star Trek. Star Trek's of the time. It's taking trends. You know, the Kazon are based on, you know, things going on in society at the time. You know, a lot of this stuff is... To me, this is just the most hilariously heavy-handed one, but there is something about them to me that makes them feel very novel. Like, I remember watching these episodes and asking, like, why had I never heard of the Malon? Because they feel so weird.
They do, but it's because they're such a distinct... Okay, they've got the distinct look, and also, you mentioned the hook behind the Talaxians and how there ultimately wasn't really that strong of a hook.
Yeah.
They have such an obvious hook here, and I could also believe the Malon... They are polluting the quadrant for light years to come, which is why Voyager kept encountering them.
Yeah.
And it made sense to me. Like, I think, you know, ultimately, if we ever saw like a Star Trek Voyager feature film,
right,
you could totally get a Malon cameo in there. Like, it would totally work, like, in cinema. Like, nowadays, they'd be like, oh, yeah, look at them pollute.
Well, when we talked about the Vidians and how they could be what could happen to humanity, you know, like, a lot of these, you know, I think the really strong Star Trek species, you can make some sort of parallel between your heroes or just humanity as a whole. You can see that very, very clearly with the Malon. I mean, it's not even subtle.
No.
And, you know, I like that element of them. To me... I think the problem with the Malon maybe is the visual. I don't
really.
Believe me, they're noxious and they are very unpleasant to look at. Like, they're very memorable. They stick in your head. But I wonder if they're a species. When you show these things, people don't really want to see them. Whereas I think when you show a Klingon, when you show, you know, Jem'Hadar, whatever, like, people like them.
They were too effective in what they were trying to convey.
Yes.
Okay.
Like, they were very off-putting. In a way that maybe the Vidians weren't. Like, the Vidians look kind of cool. You could say, like, you could see how, like, horror movie people could really get into something like the Vidians.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't know that anyone is a big fan of the visual look of the Malon. I mean, like, you and I have gone to many a Star Trek con. Have you ever seen anyone cosplay as a Malon?
No, I've never even thought about that before.
Yeah.
Like, would they have to, like, douse themselves in, like, garbage water before they came down to the convention floor? Is that it? Like, maybe that's why.
I suppose, but... it just, to me, seems like a species that, considering the number of episodes they're in a, you know, a reasonable amount, you know, about on par with the Vidians, or, you know, less than the Hirogen, but, you know, they're in a number.
I think they're only like 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Yeah,
3 or 4. But that's a few.
Yeah.
You know, enough to become something that people recognize.
I think we got enough of the Malon.
Yeah.
And I'm glad if a species doesn't wear out its welcome. And I never felt as if the Vidians wore out their welcome.
Yeah.
Never felt as if the Hirogen wore out their welcome. I never felt as if the Malon, that had, I think, the potential to wear out their welcome, they never did so.
Right.
So.
No, I think that's a good point.
Kim, do we want to jump into a bit of a rapid-fire round where we can tackle, I think, species that are maybe not kind of the primary species of the Delta Quadrant, but they're still notable, they're still kind of cool, that they're maybe worth like a couple sentences.
Yeah, I've got a couple.
Okay. Let's go with this. You actually convinced me to reconsider this, but the Voth. This is from Distant Origin. These are actually the dinosaur aliens.
Yeah.
And I rewatched this episode doing some research for this, and it's fascinating. These are species that, I guess, persisted here on Earth as dinosaurs, and Chakotay posits that maybe their cities were buried underwater or through volcanic activity, but they became spacefaring species,
right.
Made it all the way to the DQ, evolved. To me, the Voth are very rich in that they have these kind of, these circles. That's what they call them. It's like circles.
Right.
Where it's this very, I would say, dominant sort of hierarchy throughout them, and they even make a point of doing that with like kind of the caste system, about like how the main scientist Gagan, he has a daughter who his assistant has eyes for, but the assistant isn't part of the same caste, and then Gagan's like, but you know what, it's all good. And then the two dudes chuckle to each other, which I find incredibly creepy,
right?
But to me, I think the Voth were very rich in that they really showed, like, no matter how evolved this species was, they've been, you know, flying through outer space for millions of years, they were very much prone to still kind of that, I guess, religious sort of institutionalism that persists even in our society nowadays, which I found very fascinating. What was your take on the Voth, Cam?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of them. First off, just visually, they look great.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Voyager would fall into the trap a lot of the other Star Trek series did with the bumpy-headed aliens, but it really felt like they went all out with the designs of these of the Voth. And, you know, I'm a big Planet of the Apes fan, and this was, like, such an homage to, like, Planet of the Apes. I mean, the writers have said, no, it wasn't, but it's pretty close.
Sure.
I mean, it's really, really on the nose. But to me, yeah, like, I'm a big fan of this episode. I liked that it just feel just like this kind of standalone oddity episode where it's just kind of telling its own story. You know, I wish Star Trek would sometimes do that more, tell these episodes that feel kind of just like almost like one-off side stories.
But he even started for like, I think the first two or three acts, all from the perspective of the Voth.
Which I really enjoy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would love more stuff like this.
Right. What's next for you, though?
Okay, well, I want to talk about the alien, which is unnamed species, in the episode Night, which is the episode where they're in perpetual darkness, and there's this species that lives in the dark, and it's being poisoned by the Malon. I really like this alien. It's very unique looking.
These were the ones that couldn't speak, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's about, you know, the crew communicating with them, I believe, through music, isn't it?
Like, yeah,
musical
it's,
notes.
Well,
yeah.
Of course, it's the Doctor who has to come to save the day through music.
But again, like, you know, I'll get back to this with another one of my quick picks, but this is a species that feels alien. And I like the idea of Voyager being in the Delta Quadrant, away from everything, and discovering aliens that feel unlike anything we've seen before. And this is a perfect example of it.
Well, it seems as if they did put a lot of thought into, because this was like a season premiere, and they're like, they wanted to make it memorable. And so I like when they actually put a lot of thought into, A, not just the look of a species, but what its society would be like. And yeah, to me, this totally worked. We even get to work in kind of the Malon reference to it all.
Yeah.
And yeah. I'm totally down.
Is that the first Malon episode, too?
I think it is.
Yeah.
But
it is, yeah.
The thing is here, though, like, with the Night aliens, I don't think there's any potential for them to ever return.
No.
And I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like Distant Origin. It's like a great design, really well thought out species. You just get that one episode for.
Do you think we could have ever seen a return of the Voth, though?
I think it's easier to bring back the Voth than the aliens from Night.
Yeah. Okay. Would you have wanted to see a return of the Voth, or are you completely satisfied?
No. I'm very satisfied with the episode we got.
Yeah.
And actually, that episode, it's funny you mentioned that, because Birth Movies Death, which is a film website, very popular one, just posted a really good article on, it's, I believe it's called In Defense of Voyager. And it's someone who, the writer went back and rewatched all of Voyager and wrote about the series and kind of how its reputation is, it's generally looked down upon compared to the other series. And it's him kind of defending the series. And he highlights what he thinks are the best episodes and Distant Origins on the list.
Well, I'll say this, like, every time we do... Maybe it's the fault of, like, you and I, but, like, I don't think we focus on Voyager enough, but whenever right. we do a Voyager-centric episode...
Not the Voyager episode.
Voyager. I'm always happy with kind of the research that we're doing. Like, this is a yeah. very fun one to research. Like, yeah. I had a blast doing this, and it gives me more appreciation for Voyager, and maybe I don't look down upon it as much as I did previously.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we can talk about the aliens that don't work, like the Kazon or whatever, but what I like is that... Even if the central, you know, lack of sort of drama to the Voyager crew's journey doesn't work for you, there's a lot of creativity yeah. filling out that world that I think contributes a lot. Where even something as maybe ill-conceived as the Kazon, there's a lot of thought put into it. And, you know, they gave them a look, for example, that's wacko and out there. Like, they weren't, you know, they took a shot at it. They didn't just throw some bumpy heads on them and be like, good enough. So, you know.
Next one on my list here are the Overlooker species. These are the ones that were first introduced in Tinker, Taylor, Doctor, Spy. They were the ones that were obsessed with surveillance and then right. reporting back to the hierarchy. They had such a distinct look with their portly features in those big kind of balloon suits. And I also like the fact that they had this hierarchy that they always had to report to. And so you can see that they were actually like a kind of a thought out sort of species. And that's always what I kind of grasp onto, as opposed to like the random bumpy forward alien that shows up on the Voyager's view screen and you never hear from them again.
Right.
Like, they actually, and they popped up, I think, like two or three, maybe even four times, like throughout Voyager's run. They totally work for me. Like, did they pop for you, Cam? Okay, after you saw Tinker, Taylor, Dr. Spy,
yeah.
I mean, were you ever interested in seeing them again, or were you happy that you did see them pop up once more?
That episode's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know that, like, when I was done with the episode, I felt like I need to see this species more. Like,
sure.
There's so much more to explore. But, you know, I think they worked. I think they did their job. And what they did best, I think, is that they stood out. Like, they didn't feel like just phoning it in that week
right.
for your aliens. And that, to me, is, you know, always important. And, you know, that kind of brings me to my next one, which is they kind of actually do fall a little bit into the bumpy-headed, but I think what they do with their culture is interesting enough that it makes an episode really great, and that's the episode Critical Care,
okay,
which yeah. is sort of the healthcare parallel episode, where, I mean, I'm not going to say that these are the most, you know, richly designed aliens, but their world, I think, does a lot of what Star Trek does best, which is take a real-world issue and tackle it from the point of view of science fiction.
Okay. But as a Canadian, is yes. it really a real-world issue for you?
Well, it's an American issue.
Yeah. But was it something that you really...
I mean, here's the thing. I have never dealt with the issues that the characters are dealing with in this episode. However, I hear enough about it, and I'm aware enough of its existence in the rest of the world, or in places throughout the rest of the world, that it has a power to me. Because
okay.
it's
yeah.
not something I can look at and be like, well, that's just ridiculous fiction. You know, like, I know this happens, and I think that episode does a great job in communicating sort of the outrage and the frustration of that situation.
Okay. No, I totally get it, but, like, I remember by the time that I watched that episode, we had already moved, my family had already moved back up to Canada from
right.
the United States, and I guess the other funny thing is that, like, I mean, we had full coverage down in the United States,
sure.
but I can only imagine, like, the inequity that persists to this day.
Yeah.
Even as, like, they're trying to gut Obamacare. I wonder how this episode plays, because I haven't rewatched this episode in a long time. And I wonder how this episode replays nowadays as we see the current U.S. administration actively trying to gut not quite universal healthcare, but the closest thing that the United States has to it outside of, like, the state of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
So I wonder how this one plays now for especially those American audiences.
Yeah, be curious to know. But, you know, this is a species that, like, what I liked is that their world and society feels, like, very thought out.
Well,
for just their
exactly.
single episode, and
yes.
that's what I appreciated.
Okay. Next one, again, they're not... Maybe they do fall into the bumpy-headed alien category, but I do kind of dig them. But the D'Vor Imperium, and mostly because it's one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek Voyager with Counterpoint. But in that,
yeah.
they have control over a very vast swath of space.
That's a great pick, yeah.
And they are very xenophobic. You have telepathic powers? Uh-uh. They're very kind of Nazi-esque, and I think that's very on the nose of part of the writers. But I found them fascinating in that we see so many layers, especially with the main character, the inspector, that we're following throughout this episode, and whether or not he was or was not a defector. But it seems as if the DeVore were kind of richly thought out, and then there were many layers towards this particular species as well.
It was always kind of crazy to me they didn't find a way to do more with them.
Well, okay, because
that is such a great episode.
They reference them like later on in the series too, and I'm just like,
and you have so much chemistry between Janeway and main character, and we saw like Janeway was a character. You know, Kate Mulgrew has said she didn't want Janeway to have like big love interests on the show, which is fine. You know, that's her choice, but. What I liked was with these two characters, there's that at least tension, you know, which we don't get an episode in, like, Fairhaven, for example. Well, but I think it would have been great to bring this character back and just have the sparks between him and Janeway, even if you're not going to have a romance or whatever.
So I could totally understand Mulgrew, like, resisting kind of, like, a ship-bound romance with, you know, say, Chakotay. I totally get that, even though, like, I mean, there is a little chemistry between her and Robert Beltran.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I would say that I could totally buy her, you know, like, pursuing a relationship with, like, an alien.
Right.
You know? Like, especially when you have so much chemistry between the two actors that were doing this. I just wonder if this episode turned out so much better than maybe the writers even intended, just because of the chemistry that popped between the two actors here.
I just wonder if it's the issue with the character of Janeway is she's so single-minded on getting all of her people home. She has a lot on her plate. And so the idea that she would also be having a romance, maybe that's unrealistic.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because, you know, I know people that are very stressed out parents. They don't have a lot of time for other activities. So I can totally understand this in the point of view from Janeway.
Yeah.
So, and Kate Mulgrew. Lastly, I just want to highlight the aliens from Equinox.
Yeah,
we don't learn a lot about them, really, and they are, you know, kind of treated as sort of a device of what's driving the plot. But what I liked about them is the same thing I like about 8472 or the aliens even in Night, which is that they feel so unusual and hard to comprehend that I would have liked to have seen maybe more communication between them and the Voyager crew.
So because I watched Equinox and I thought that was like kind of a perfect encapsulation of those species that we got to explore there. I never felt like, I thought they were fascinating, but I never felt compelled as if we needed to revisit them. Would you have liked to have revisited them?
I don't think you need to, but I would have been interested in maybe an episode where we just kind of work with them a little more.
Did they seem a little derivative of 8472 to you?
Not really, and I think it's because of just the way they're portrayed on screen. To me, doesn't feel like 8472.
But to me, I'm thinking, hey, it's a season finale. It's these CG characters from like a different dimension. You know, instead of being giant, they're kind of small.
Right.
So that was my take.
I didn't really make that much of a connection with them because to me, 8472 is such a species that's kind of in control of the situation and such a fearsome opponent.
Yeah.
Whereas these aren't so much.
Last one for me here, the Vardwar. This is from Dragon's Teeth, in which they launch these species out of stasis. They've been under stasis for about 900 years, and Voyager forms an alliance with them, and they realize, oh, this is kind of a warrior species that wants to retake these subspace corridors and kind of dominate the galaxy once again after they've been decimated.
Right.
The interesting thing here, though, and this is why I always love kind of the internal conflict and the layers, but, like, essentially, the main Vardwar character that they've been dealing with, he has undergone sufficient loss, and he says to the crew, look, not everyone is willing to just kind of be this dominant species again. Like, we don't want to just continually, like, conquer and attack. Like, let me work with them. Like we can convince enough of them to get out of this kind of warrior-like mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the episode, Janeway says, it's not the last we've ever seen of them. That's for sure, Seven. And it was the last that we ever saw of them. And to me, they had such a cool, distinct look. They kind of look like cobra snakes.
Right.
And I like the idea of a species that had like 900-year-old technology, but like also access to cool technology like these subspace corridors. Like, there's potential behind them. And it seemed as if we could have visited the Vardwar at least once or twice more before I would have gotten sick of them. And so I think there's some unrealized potential here.
Yeah, it's always interesting how they can really latch onto such a strong alien in an episode and just kind of let them go, which is very original series, actually, you know, where they introduce something like the Gorn and they're like, well, that's that, you know, they're done, moving on.
But it is funny that it's such a different era of different television. Era,
but it is almost like it baked into the tradition of Star Trek to a certain degree. Like, you create these cool things and you move on.
All right, so, Kim...
I just realized I just want to do a quick shout-out because I just realized the robot from Prototype.
Oh, you know, okay. I actually had that on my list.
It popped into my head just a second ago and I was like, I have to mention that because I love that episode. I love the idea of these kind of like 50s-esque, you know, sci-fi robots showing up on Star Trek. I just love that.
Just to prove that I've done my research, the species that actually, like, built them, those are the Prelor.
Right.
And so that was cool.
Yeah.
I'll give one last shout-out as well.
Sure.
The Macrocosm aliens. Yeah, like, those choice. Are pretty cool. I mean, it's such a ripoff of the movie Alien.
Yeah.
But I don't care. It was such a badass Janeway episode, and those Macrocosm aliens are pretty cool.
For sure.
So, Kim, I think maybe we want to take the time to discuss a big sci-fi property that's tangentially related to our podcast, and that a couple years ago we did a Star Trek versus Star Wars podcast, and since then we've talked about the number of Star Wars movies that have come out.
And just 2 weeks ago we did an episode on prequels.
Yes, so. Which I think is very, well, maybe you can figure out where we're going here, especially since we pretty much spelled it out earlier on in this Voyager episode here.
Right.
Let's talk about a little bit about Solo.
Which is just blowing up the box office right now.
Not so much.
Yeah.
But tell me a little bit. I mean, before we went and saw Solo, we were having dinner with a couple friends, and we asked everybody around the table to kind of rank the new...
Like the Disney era Star Wars
Disney era Star Wars films. And I think this is actually kind of helpful for listeners to just kind of get into our personal mindsets before we kind of share our own thoughts on this new movie. I'll throw it to you. The four movies that have come out, Force Awakens, Last Jedi, Rogue One, and Solo, how would you rank them?
For me, it's Last Jedi at the top, followed by Rogue One, followed by The Force Awakens, followed by Solo.
Okay.
With a bit of a gap between Force Awakens and Solo.
Okay. Yeah. For me personally, I would do Last Jedi, then Force Awakens, then Rogue One, and then Solo. So we're not too far apart.
No.
But let me ask you overall thoughts, just kind of general thoughts, and then maybe we can dig into the minutia a little bit.
Yeah, Solo to me is interesting in that this was a movie I actively dreaded. Like, when I heard, you know, the announcement of this movie, it very much grated on me. I was like, this is not necessary. Like, this is not something that I want to see a prequel to Han Solo. To me, it just is like mining a well-known character purely just for profit. Like, it didn't seem like a good idea to me. And so I was definitely not a big fan of this idea. And then there's all the production problems with, you know, the directors getting fired and then Ron Howard being brought in. And I'm just like, oh, God, like, what am I walking into?
Yeah.
And then the marketing was kind of Deadsville. I will say I enjoyed the movie. Like, overall, I would say this is a perfectly pleasant, you know, like, B-minus blockbuster where I walked out of it. I was like, you know, there's a lot of fun elements to it. I think it has two really, really fun performances in Donald Glover as Lando and Paul Bettany as the villain. I don't think Alden Ehrenreich embarrassed himself as Han Solo at all. Like, I thought he was fine. The movie felt cohesive. It didn't feel like a mess with two directors directing chunks of it.
So, listeners, we do have to pay homage to Helen, who...
And who is Helen, Tyler?
Helen is my girlfriend who has to endure Cam and I every week setting up in this apartment that Helen and I share, recording the podcast. She just wrote me a note that said, "Yawn Solo!" exclamation mark, which cracked me up, and Cam giggled just a little bit as well. Thank you, Helen.
But no, I mean, I'm a big Star Wars fan from way back, and I walked out of the movie being like...
Since The Phantom Menace.
Since that's the one that did it. But I walked out being like, I had a decent time with this movie. Like, it didn't grate on me.
Yeah.
There was one part at the very end that I loathed, but, and I think fans will, you know, who will know what I'm talking about. It's a surprise reveal, but...
Maybe...
I'm not going to spoil it.
Okay.
There's a lot of people that haven't seen this movie, judging from box office numbers. Right. You know, it's the first Star Wars movie, though, where I walked out being like, I don't care if I ever see this again. Like, it feels like kind of a fun, watch once, forget about kind of movie, which I think is maybe a real problem.
I 100% agree in that I feel no compulsion to ever see this again. I find, okay, so this is a weird thing here. I find Rogue One to be a very flawed film.
Yeah.
I I don't have any...
Also with similar production issues.
Well, here's the weird thing. I don't have any negative feelings towards Solo. Right. I watched it. I thought it was perfectly watchable, inoffensive. It's a Ron Howard movie.
Yeah.
Whereas I actually do have kind of negative feelings towards Rogue One. But if you ask me what I would want to rewatch again, it'd be Rogue One. I've seen Rogue One twice.
Yeah.
I think there's so many more, despite all its flaws...
Especially in the first half.
I think there's so many more interesting things going on in Rogue One, where Solo just seemed so vanilla. It was just playing it safe. I think this is a script that seemed as if it came out of the 1990s.
What's really weird is that Lawrence Kasdan co-wrote this script, and this was his project. Like, he was, I mean, the rumor was he was the reason that the original directors were replaced by Ron Howard. Like, because Lawrence Kasdan did not like what they were doing to his pet project. Like, this was his passion project. And his retirement from Star Wars, like, to him, Solo was, like, the big deal. Like, this is the guy who co-wrote, you know, Empire Strikes Back. He wrote Raiders of the Lost Ark. He is a Hollywood legend. And this was the project he saw as, like, his farewell to Star Wars.
Yeah.
It's so strange, right?
Because you wonder what he was so passionate about exactly. Yeah. Because it seemed to me like a very pat storyline. Like, the thing about Star Wars... okay, you know, I'm actually going to go back to this. I'm going to go back to... A franchise like Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Where I think one of the reasons why it appeals to so many people is because it subverts so many of the expectations of the genre.
Right.
Does Solo to you subvert any expectations within this sci-fi genre at all? Because you watch a movie like the original Star Wars, and I think it's very successful at doing that. Empire Strikes Back follows up and does that yet again.
Yeah. We can argue if Return does, but it pays off that arc.
But you know, even look at the story. At the prequels,
yeah,
it's like, say what you will about them, they're very imaginative. They are like swinging for those home runs,
especially in terms of technical ambition. Like, Lucas was trying to do things that had never been done before.
But Solo, a Star Wars story, is the first time I've walked out of a Star Wars movie and thought they really weren't trying to do anything very interesting.
Yeah, because I look at Rogue One, you know, which has its narrative issues, I think, especially in the first half. Yeah, with, you know, the Forrest Whitaker stuff and things like that don't quite work as well. But you look at what they were trying to stage with its big third act action sequence. Like, that is a level of complication to action staging we'd never seen in terms of showing, like, military combat in Star Wars. Like, it showed me something I'd never seen before in that franchise. Whereas, like, Solo didn't show me... anything that I hadn't seen before.
No, not at all.
Which was just very curious, because then I go back to, like, this movie is, and this is largely due to the reshoots, but the most expensive Star Wars movie ever made.
Yeah, I think there's estimates ranging from, I've heard two different numbers, like between $250 and $300 million for a film.
And I walk away going like, well, okay, I can look at every Star Wars movie and say, what did this bring? Like, even like Return of the Jedi, which is... maybe a little more modest compared to the first two that preceded it. But you look at the amount of creativity going on, for example, with all the stuff with Jabba's Palace.
Yeah, yeah.
And all the creature creations that are going on. It's very ambitious stuff. I look at Solo and I'm like, what was the thing that excited anyone about this project? Because there's nothing about it that I look at and go, man, they must have, when they were putting that together, been like, we have something amazing here.
I go back to... a podcast I was listening to earlier today, focused on the movie Annihilation that you and I saw in theaters maybe January, February.
Yeah.
And the film critic who's discussing this, Matt Zollersites, he's the editor at large at RogerEbert.com, but he was talking so much about how it's meant to just get some feelings out of the audience. Like, you're meant to... have this movie stick with you for an extended period of time. And is there anything from Solo where I constantly felt as if this movie was like answering the questions we never asked? How did he get, you know, and I don't want to spoil anything, but there's just like a
constant. You could say, like, there's things like, you know, how did he get his name, or
did anyone ever care?
How did he get the Falcon?
Did anyone ever have questions about how he got the Falcon?
That was pretty well known within canon. So it's like they established that.
And I think the reason, like, Kasdan wanted to do this one is, like, he wanted to, like, explore the Kessel Run.
Yeah.
Did anyone really need to see that realized on the big screen? Like, I don't think so.
Okay,
like,
and let's say that, okay, you know, and sure, the Kessel Run sequence is fairly large in the movie. I think if you want to do the Kessel Run when you're going into this movie, maybe that's the thing you're like, okay, we need to do something that no one has ever seen in terms of, you know, like, ship sequences. And they don't. Like, that's the thing. Like, I mean, there are some stuff we've never seen in Star Wars before, but it's not done in any way that's particularly exciting or exhilarating. And to me, like, you need to at least be able to pick something and say, like, what excited them? And I think this is a problem with prequels, and we talked about it in that prequel podcast, is that filling in backstory is not satisfying a lot of the time.
But it's profoundly not compelling.
Yes.
It's what's compelling about cinema is conflict. And filling in how, you know, he met Chewbacca.
Sure.
Spoiler alert.
Which is well done, I thought. But, you know.
Was it?
I liked it. I will say it's not something I ever expected to see. Like, okay. I did not anticipate how they were going to do that. So, I'll give them that. You're laughing.
I'm just thinking about, like, Chewbacca couldn't figure out how to punch a pole.
Yeah, well, that part maybe. But I mean, in terms of the actual scenario that brings them together was something that...
Didn't they establish that it was like a blood oath that brought them together?
Yeah, they seem to get rid of that, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
But
To me, I just... Okay. We haven't really spoiled anything.
No,
but
no.
But, like, I want to say this. What if you watch, like, a caper that had zero tension to this? Did you ever feel as if there was any tension throughout this film? I felt as if every single, you know, kind of action sequence or what have you, there was no tension.
I thought the one on the train actually had moments of tension.
Actually, that was the one that stood out to me
as
having...
That's the first one in the movie. Yeah.
That's the one that stood out to me as having no tension. I was just like, oh, this is going to be a long movie. Like, this is the big first action sequence.
Yeah.
You can make arguments, but,
right,
like, the car... Well, anyway. I didn't feel as if there's any tension. And I know, like, other think pieces I've read, and I've listened to, I think, like, 3 podcasts so far since the movie came out, and they keep going back to the card games.
Right.
And, like, there's zero tension.
I think you need to establish the rules of the game
for
people to care.
But go back to a movie like Casino Royale.
Yeah.
Which, like, I'm not a big, like, poker player or what have you. Like, that was one of the best, like, card sequences I've ever seen in cinema. And, like, to me, this just seemed like kind of like such a throwaway scene.
Yeah.
Or there are multiple throwaway scenes with cards. It's just like, I don't know. Like, ultimately, this will go down as the most forgettable Star Wars movie, period.
With the exception of that Clone Wars animated movie.
That doesn't count.
That doesn't count.
Yeah,
so. No, I agree 100%. And, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of kind of throwing kind of rocks at the movie because of its box office performance. And I don't even really feel like it even deserves that. Like, to me, it's so fine. Like, it's a fine movie. I think if you go, you'll get an engaging 2 hours and you'll walk out and be like, well, that theater was nice and air-conditioned.
Yeah.
You know, like, you're not going to walk out unhappy or pissed off. Well, but you're just going to be like, well, that was fine.
No, because I'll say this again. Like, Rogue One, I think about that movie, and I actually have kind of negative feelings toward it. Han Solo, I have no negative feelings toward it, but I rank Rogue One higher. I just think it was so much more ambitious. It had way more interesting things going on, even though I think it's ultimately flawed.
Yeah.
I'll take a movie that has all these flaws over a movie that is from, I guess, the Da Vinci Code sort of,
right, like... Although this is far better made than the Da Vinci Code movies.
Yeah.
But I was just curious, though, how did you feel about the characters?
So I think it suffers from one of the same problems I had with Rogue One, is that I didn't quite care about the characters so much.
Yeah.
You've got an actor like Woody Harrelson who's incredibly charismatic. As much as I legitimately hated the movie 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, I thought Woody Harrelson...
He deserved that Oscar nomination.
He was great in that. But did you care about Tobias Beckett?
No.
And was it distracting for you that you had a Ron Howard film that had a side character named Tobias?
Oh, yes. So much so.
Okay. Arrested Development showed up.
The part where he showed up in blue paint was really distracting. Yeah,
not at all, because he was an alien.
But to me, like, you know, there's a couple characters in this movie that play a pivotal role in the Han Solo story.
Who did you care about, though?
Well, I didn't care about the ones that had a pivotal effect on the story. And I think that's a problem. Like, I want those relationships to work like gangbusters, because then there's an emotional takeaway from the movie, whereas there wasn't. And I think that's a problem, a big part of the problem, because I think people will forgive, you know, a maybe less than memorable action sequence if they walk out feeling something. And that's the problem, is that I don't think you feel anything walking out of it.
So, Cam, I think ultimately what we want to dive into now is, where does Star Wars go from here?
Yeah.
So the next one that's going to come out, is that the J.J. Abrams conclusion to the Skywalker?
Episode 9 is the only one in production. There's, you know, they announced, I think, maybe the day they opened Solo, that James Mangold is going to do the Boba Fett film.
Sure.
There's an Obi-Wan one that's not nailed down 100%, but it looks like Ewan McGregor is going to do an Obi-Wan spinoff movie. There's the Rian Johnson trilogy. There's the however many movies coming from the guys that did Game of Thrones. So there's a lot of, I think there's 8 Star Wars movies, you know, something like that, currently circling around waiting to see, you know, right now I feel like the future is more uncertain than it was a week ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's...
To me, I'll say it didn't excite me that J.J. Abrams is coming back to conclude the trilogy. I think, look, I think Star Trek 2009 is one of the best Star Trek films ever made, but
yeah.
I think about whether J.J. Abrams is going to have the guts to do something super out there, like something that's really going to shake up the franchise, which I think is what this franchise needs right now. I think he'll do kind of like a play-by-number sort of like glide the plane to, you know, stick the landing.
Right.
You know, I think that's what his plan is.
He's also dealing with very unfortunate circumstances with Carrie Fisher being gone.
But I think he can work around
sure.
that. I'm not particularly intrigued by either a Boba Fett or an Obi-Wan Kenobi spinoff.
Obi-Wan one does not interest me at all, at all. But I will say the one thing about the Boba Fett is, I first off did not want a Boba Fett movie. Like Han Solo, I feel like Boba Fett movie is a fundamental misunderstanding of that character, who should be a side character and in the shadows.
Yeah.
But I will say, like, James Mangold has a real fascination with, like, spaghetti westerns and doing very classical western tropes. And to me, it's like, if this Boba Fett movie is going to happen no matter what, and it will, because it's a very marketable character and they can sell a lot of merch off Boba Fett, the idea of James Mangold bringing that sort of Western spirit to it is, I think, the best way to tackle that character if you are going to make that movie.
My issue with James Mangold, though, is that he's always a director who you can see on the screen, he's striving for greatness, and all he ever gets to is pretty good.
Although I think Logan... it's probably his high watermark.
I would say so, but I would still not call it a great film. I would still say it's above and beyond, say, Copland or, you know, 310 to Yuma.
Or The Wolverine.
Or The Wolverine.
Yeah.
So I don't think that James Mangold's going to be the one who's going to end up blowing me away with a Star Wars film. Is it the King's Speech director who's going to be doing
Obi-Wan Kenobi? No, it's the director of The Reader and Extremely Reader. Loud and Incredibly Close.
Okay,
this just sounds dire.
That fills me with dread.
Yeah, like, I'd say dump that one. Like, honestly, just dump it.
The Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not against an Obi-Wan movie with Ewan McGregor. I think he's really a charming actor, and I thought he was really great, you know, kind of channeling Alec Guinness. I think he could totally do it, but whatever they're planning with this guy, I just dump it.
So, I guess what I'm looking forward to is the Rian Johnson trilogy. Yeah. And as much as, and I even referenced Game of Thrones earlier on, I don't think that Weiss and Benioff are actually the guys to do an open-ended sort of Star Wars, you know, movie series.
Yeah.
I think this one is... whatever they have planned, I don't think it's going to be ending well.
Right.
Like, I don't know how to articulate it quite well. I think what they've done with Game of Thrones, at least, you know, I would say 4 out of the seasons that they've done has just been, like, earth-shattering, like,
right,
mind-blowing.
Yeah.
I don't know if they've got what it takes to actually do this open-ended Star Wars series. I'm very fearful of what's going to come next. So I have more hope for the future of the Star Trek film franchise than I do for the Star Wars film franchise at this point.
I think Disney needs to decide whether they want Star Wars to be a perpetual money earner or a quick burn. Because the thing is, like, you know, if you go back to the Star Wars model where these movies come out every couple years and you have gaps between your films, I think you could make money forever, because I think people will see them more as events and want to, you know, you'll have this generational thing where people want to bring their kids to the next trilogy and that sort of thing. But if they want to burn these movies off, like, up to 2 a year, you're going to get to a point where these movies are, like, not bringing in the audiences they want anymore. And it's like, well, then you better start cutting the budgets and... they just have to decide what they want to do, because they're spending a lot on these movies.
It's going to be like those Battle of Endor movies pretty soon, right?
So I think that's what they need to decide. And I think putting the prestige back in Star Wars helps them. long term. I just don't know if they care about long term or their stockholders care about long term. But to me, the spinoffs are diluting that. Prequels dilute that. It's kind of like, you know, in a weird way, and this is a much larger scale, but it reminds me a little bit of when Disney started putting out animated sequels to all their famous movies, where you got like Little Mermaid 2 and the Cinderella sequels, all that sort of thing. And they were obvious cash-ins, and they were made just to appeal to the brand names and bring in people who, you know, all the kids who love those movies. And they ended up being a real problem, and people didn't like them. And I believe John Lasseter, who's now a little disgraced, but when he took over, that was the first thing he did was shut down that whole department because he felt it was diluting the brand. And I think they just need to look at the Star Wars brand, decide how long do we want this to last for?
Like, make them feel more like events like they have in the past.
Yeah, so I think when they close off this new trilogy, I do hope they focus maybe more on the Rian Johnson trilogy. And these spinoffs are a problem. I don't have a problem with sequels that maybe introduce new characters or things like that, but I think the idea of just doing prequels to establish characters, I mean, if you can't bring in a big audience on opening weekend for a Han Solo movie, I don't know how much a Ben Kenobi movie is going to excite people.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that's kind of how I feel. But Solo, it's fine.
Perfectly watchable.
Yeah.
Still at the bottom of my list of all these new Star Wars films.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's the most forgettable Star Wars movie ever made, which is weird, except for the Ewok TV movies, but whatever.
But that's memorable.
They are memorable. That's true. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, I've been teasing this for a little while, not to our listeners, but to you.
Right.
We're finally going to do it. We're going to draft our ultimate Star Trek crew.
Oh, my God. This is the episode that's been in the workings for, like, how long?
Probably 2 years.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
But I figured out a way that it won't be this, like, monster of an episode that'll be impossible to arrange. It's going to be a fun one. And I think just the title that I gave kind of spells it out for listeners. It'll be fun. Believe me. Cam, you and I, we're going to really go like toe-to-toe with like who's going to be able to create the best crew ever.
I'm excited about this. Yeah. I used to ask you about what was going on with this episode and then I just stopped.
Because you know what? I had such high ambitions. I was going to try to get every single guest that has ever been on our show before to be involved somehow. And then I realized, what am I doing? Like, let's...
Ben Young doesn't return phone calls.
I know. Let's simplify this.
Right.
So I figured out a way that'll make it work. And so tune in next week. It's going to be a fun one.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vidians or Voth. I don't know. Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N as in nobody wants Kenobi.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.